A lot more to learn about protecting my instrument if I was going to move forward in professional theater. I wasn't sure what was supposed to come next, but when I took my last bow as a member of the Broadway company of Rent, I was officially a young man without a dream. I did, however, make a wish that this would not be the last bow I took on a Broadway stage. The slate was wiped clean with the realization of my wildest dream. Now what? There were a few pressing matters that needed to be addressed. First, I needed to graduate from high school. A look into my transcript revealed I was a tiny bit ahead academically, and if I took advanced English and math classes at the local community college, I could graduate on time with the rest of my senior class. I enrolled at the Community College of Philadelphia in January. I was in school 2 days a week. I got a job at a grocery store to make some dough and fill the rest of the day. I got back into dance classes. I applied for colleges and prepared for the round of auditions that would accompany the application process. I'd heard or read the name Carnegie Mellon again and again in my 3-month New York adventure. It was listed in the program as the training ground for some of the people I'd come to respect most during my time there. Among them was Michael McElroy. Michael played Tom Collins in Rent while I was there. Mike is formidable in every way that counts. He was barely 30, with a handful of starring roles on and off Broadway, one of the most gorgeous and effortless voices I'd ever heard, and a clearly visible technical process that sustained and supported him 8 shows a week. I wanted to be Michael McElroy. Michael was also a friend to me. If he saw me doing something he didn't feel was professional, he had a way of intervening and getting me to pull back on my own reins. He wanted to get to me before anyone in management had a chance to. "Pull up," he would say, and I knew what he meant. Whenever Michael would pull me aside to pass on some knowledge or give advice, he could do it without ego or debasement. Michael didn't want to humiliate me. When he could, he wanted to help. I will always be grateful. I tried not to bother Michael much, but every now and then I could step into his dressing room to run something by him or to ask him a question about the business that he seemed to know almost everything about. On my last weekend of the show, I'd gone to him with my plans for what I might do next. "I'm going to apply to colleges," I began. "Oh, yeah? What are you thinking about?" he asked. "NYU, Fordham. Think I'd like to be in New York." Michael nodded slightly. He never stopped his flow. He was getting ready for the show we had in half an hour. "Go to Carnegie. It's where I went. They'll get you ready." I had my marching orders from McElroy. We were raised with an eye toward college always. My parents didn't care what we studied. They didn't care what college we ultimately decided to go to. We just had to go. It was a minimum requirement for them. Going back to my days in the sad face box, I'd always had a tough time with authority and the expectation of unquestioned obedience. By the time I was graduating from high school, I was so bored with the cookie-cutter, one-size-fits-all curriculum, I couldn't wait to have some autonomy in my education. I confidently applied to theater programs at 4 universities. By this time, I had been training formally for about 4 years and informally for even longer. I had a high school resume full of competition wins and even a Broadway credit. I thought I'd have a range of college acceptance letters and choices of where to study. Now, I hadn't forgotten about Michael McElroy's marching orders, but I couldn't deny the allure of studying in New York so that I might keep 1 foot in the industry while attending university. Rejection letters came in from Fordham and NYU back to back. Bam, bam. It threw me. I wasn't sure how to feel. My ego was bruised, for sure. But over time, I've come to learn that try as we might to knock down all barriers, every now and then we have to trust the closed door. And so I did. New York was out. Both feet would have to be planted in my studies. I'd been accepted into the University of the Arts in downtown Philadelphia. For some, the possibility of staying close to home for college can be ideal. For me, part of the draw of attending university was getting away from home. I'm sure I wasn't the first kid to feel that way. All my eggs were in the Carnegie basket, and when the thick, perfectly square-shaped envelope showed up at my parents' door with my name on it, I breathed a deep sigh of relief. I'd been accepted to Carnegie, and best of all, while studying in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, I'd be a 5-hour car ride from everything familiar and familial. Close enough to get home quickly in a pinch, but far enough to spread my wings a bit. The Carnegie chapter of my young life was about to be a defining one. I went there thinking I knew the lessons I needed to learn. In reality, I had no clue. Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, may be one of the most misunderstood of any of the major cities in the U.S. Known as the center of the universe of the steel industry at one time, Pittsburgh has played a starring role in the history of American innovation in technology, education, and the arts. Pittsburgh natives are tough-skinned and hard-working. The local community is made up of well-educated, super-friendly folks who pride themselves on their authenticity. With 6 major universities practically next door to one another, Pittsburgh is also one of the most happening college towns in the country. Just as the ghost of Benjamin Franklin still hovers over Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, on any city street, you're never far from the lasting influence of Andrew Carnegie. Once the richest man in the world, he famously spent as many years giving away his money as he did earning it. Carnegie raised himself from poverty by reading and studying on his own. It made sense that his passion was to inspire future generations through the power of education and public enrichment. Evidence of that was everywhere, in the concert hall, museums and libraries he established, and the university he founded in 1900 that was soon to be named the Carnegie Institute of Technology, a.k.a. Carnegie Tech. Decades later, the name was changed to Carnegie Mellon University after a merger took place between Carnegie Tech and the Mellon Institute of Industrial Research. A major step in expanding Carnegie's dream beyond applied technology and putting Pittsburgh on the international stage came with the 1906 founding of the university's College of Fine Arts, one of the first in the United States for training in art, architecture, music, design, and drama. Famous names to emerge from the college include Andy Warhol, composer Stephen Schwartz, of Wicked and Pippin fame, Judith Light, Cherry Jones, and Ted Danson. More recent grads include Zachary Quinto, Patina Miller, Josh Gad, Renee Elise Goldsberry, Joe Manganiello, Matt Bomer, and on and on. Now, admittedly, when I arrived on campus in the fall of 1999, I didn't know all the bits and pieces of CMU's backstory. But a cursory glance around the campus and a walk down the hallowed marble hallways were enough for me to recognize that the School of Drama was as serious about producing leaders and innovators in the field of entertainment as Carnegie was in all other fields. The conservatory program was more intense and comprehensive than I could have known ahead of time. Private voice teachers are selected for you when you arrive. I'm not sure how they matched teachers and students, but I consider myself extraordinarily fortunate to have been paired with Thomas Douglas in my freshman year. With the ears, training, and instincts of a symphony conductor, Thomas taught me all about my voice. We studied for a single hour each week over the course of my time at Carnegie, and at the finish, Thomas had taught me how to preserve and protect my instrument. In the years since, I have never lost my voice again. If Thomas's private voice lessons were the only course I took in 4 years, it would have been worth the price of admission. If your first year in college was anything like mine, you may have found the workload more challenging than you expected. I went to theater school, and it wasn't all fun and games. So when the chance came to take a break from it for a minute and pursue an alternate route to New York via Broadway once more, my reaction was, let me think about it for 5 seconds. My plan was to be on the first thing smoking. It was just before the mid-semester break of my freshman year. I got a message at the main secretary's desk in the drama building to return a call from Bernard Telsey's office. Now, calls from Telsey's office were always a good thing. It remains that way to this day. As New York's premier casting director, Bernie and his office put together the original cast of Rent, along with the original companies of Wicked, In the Heights, Hairspray, Next to Normal, and countless others, not to mention award-winning movies and television shows. Bernie was known for being unconventional in his casting choices. He is as discerning as they come, and a great person to know in the business. Not only had Bernie cast me in Rent, he'd made sure to get me involved in a few other projects that were in development while I was in New York. All of my earliest professional experiences came out of that office. Now, the last time we'd spoken was shortly before I left for Carnegie Mellon. I'd gone through a very short audition process and been offered a principal role in the Atlanta tryout for Disney's Aida, with music written by Elton John and Tim Rice. The show was slated to come into New York immediately following the Atlanta tryout. My family talked over the terms with Bernie's office for about a week. We went back and forth about salary and accommodations. We called Michael McElroy for guidance. We weighed it all against the Carnegie Mellon acceptance letter. Ultimately, we decided that I would accept the opportunity to become a member of the class of 2003 and forego the Disney detour for now. 6 months later, the call from Bernie's office was again about Aida. They were offering the same role, this time for the Broadway transfer of the show. It was a different offer, and in just 6 months, I'd become a slightly different kid. I thought, I'm about to spend 4 years preparing to fight to walk through a door that's open right now. And turning down the opportunity twice felt risky. I hung up the phone with Bernie, who'd given me a few business days to think about it and talk it over with my folks. Now, I was pretty sure of what my decision would be. This job had my name on it. Who knew how long it would take for something like this to come around again? I could take a leave of absence, go do the show, and come back to Carnegie a year or two down the line with another Broadway credit to boot. It was the last weekend in October when I took the bus home to talk the whole thing over with my folks. My grandparents made the trip from South Carolina for the family meeting as well. Whenever I came home, I would happily lug my 8 to 10 pounds of dirty laundry from Pittsburgh to Philly, a weekend with a free washer and dryer. My father met me at the door, shouldered my duffel bag, and paused to look me in the eyes. He did this whenever he saw me after I'd been away for some time. Dad told me that I would get the final say in all this. The family would weigh in over the course of the weekend. I only had to promise to listen. I assured him I could do that. A little while later, we took our seats around the dining room table, and I was given the floor to spell out the offer as it had been presented to me. My family listened first. There was a silence after I finished. My grandfather broke it. Lenell Lenny Odom, Poppy, my grandfather, was a hilarious and indomitable spirit. In the South, during the period of his youth, the expectation on my grandfather was that after a few years of schooling, he would join the workforce and contribute to the household. Poppy, who'd only completed the fourth grade, had one of the most agile and brilliant minds I'd ever known. He warned me not to place the allure of Broadway over the chance to get my degree. Though he has been gone for quite some time, I'm not sure that I've ever fully mourned his absence. Poppy passed away after a short battle with cancer about 4 years after this meeting. It's never made sense in my brain that such a person could ever truly be gone. Somehow, for me, there's enough of him still here that it doesn't feel like he abandoned us and disappeared into thin air. I thank God for that. Speedo, Poppy said in his southern drawl, using another one of the family's nicknames for me. I want to see you walk across that stage with your cap and gown on and get that piece of paper. That'll make me jump up and down. All this stuff will be there for you when you finish. Dad chimed in. College is a golden opportunity, too. Remember how excited you were when you got your acceptance letter? Give yourself this time to develop. Set aside this time in your life for you. I listened, as I promised. It was an Odom United Front. Mom and Grandma echoed the sentiments of the patriarchs. Even my baby sister got a moment to weigh in. I was certain to have a sympathetic ear from the youngest member of our family. I think you should stay in school, she said in a quiet but confident voice. A united front indeed. The end of the weekend came. My grandparents had already started their trek home. My dad and I sat watching a movie on television in the den, killing a little time before the hour came for me to take the Greyhound back to Pittsburgh. Dad threw the question casually my way. So, have you made your decision? What do you think you might do? I considered how to break it to him. The simplest and most direct answer had to be the best way. Well, I think I'm going to accept the offer, I said. Dad looked dumbfounded. He shifted uncomfortably on the couch next to me, put the television on mute. I continued, I will absolutely go back to Carnegie in a year. They will hold my slot for me. You won't, though, he said. I will, I insisted. Dad took a cleansing breath, as if contemplating the next move in a chess match. He hadn't quite planned for this response from me. I could tell it was tearing him up, but I also believed that if it was truly my decision, then his reaction shouldn't be a deciding factor. I was prepared to stand firm. The way I saw it, the adults in my life who cared about me most were also underestimating me. They assumed that I would never return to CMU once I left. They were encouraging me to walk away from something very special with no guarantees that it would ever come around again. Maybe they'd taken my early accomplishments for granted. You booked this one, you'll book another Broadway show, but the timing will be right, Dad stated plainly. Easy for you to say, I thought. Now, he started this whole thing by saying the decision was mine, and I'd made my decision. I headed back to Pittsburgh to pack up my dorm room and say goodbye to my new friends for now. Early the next morning, far too early, I got a call from my mom on my cell phone. She'd been crying, I could tell. Her voice was thin and breaking. She said she'd been woken up at the crack of dawn to pray, that her spirit was unsettled and her stomach was turning. Through choked tears, my mom begged me to reconsider. What could I do? Half asleep and worn down, I agreed not to take the show. But I had a condition of my own. I told my sweet mother that neither she nor my dad would ever get to play this card again. I assured her it would not work the next time, and I meant it. The passageway into adulthood is a tricky one to navigate for parents and their children. I was somewhat resentful of my folks for a while, for their highly pressurized tactics. But from where I sit today, I don't blame them. They felt something strongly, and they wouldn't have been able to live with themselves if they hadn't tried everything within their power to get me to make the decision they felt was the right one. As for my development, those 4 years at Carnegie were beyond price. I'm talking about my development as a human being now, and not just how I make my living. College and university study can be the kickoff to your adventure as a lifelong learner. If you have the opportunity to give that time of exploration to yourself, you should. All the responsibilities of adulthood will be waiting for you when you finish. Poppy was right about that. There's no need to hurry it along. My folks also guided me to one of the most salient lessons of my whole life. To this day, I can't be sure if taking the show would have derailed my life or catapulted me into major success a decade and a half sooner. I also can't be certain I would have kept my word and returned to Carnegie, or if job offers would have kept coming in and school would have possibly been put off indefinitely, or if I would have wound up a 25-year-old burnout. What I can say is this. Through that process, I learned to say no, and it'll be as valuable as your yes, maybe even more so. It was an object lesson in empowerment that has stayed with me always. There is a freeing power in an honest no. It's the yang to yes's yin. Balance, as always, is key. At the urging of my folks, I walked away from a special opportunity, and though the outcome would make me a little nervous, the sky didn't cave in. Walking away angered some people on the other side of the negotiation table, with one person infamously telling me, "I'll see you in 5 years when you're waiting tables." If that was to be the outcome, then so be it. Do not let your fear or anyone else's rob you of the power of your yes and your no. Own them both and use them as you see fit. I had the time of my life at Carnegie. I learned and grew in ways that are still revealing themselves to me. I made lifelong friends. My professors taught me method and process. They taught me craft. Craft makes you reliable, and reliability gets you work. The dissolving of any fear I had left attached to the word no has been useful to me almost every day of my life since that time. Come what may, through the fat and lean years, you must retain ownership of your yes and your no. In many respects, it is all you own in this world for a very long time. Yes can come easy. No takes a bit of practice. Your no, your willingness to walk away when something doesn't feel right, for whatever the reason, will be one of the greatest assets you own. It will set you on a unique path that you'll own as well. Chapter 4, Hollywood, or The Token.
When I was a child, I spoke as a child. I understood as a child, I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. 1 Corinthians 13:11. I spent the summer after graduating from Carnegie back at home in Philly for what I hoped would be the last extended stay for a while. There was a tension at home almost always by this point. Fathers and son stuff. My plan was one more summer at home. I'd save money and then move to New York for a fresh start in the fall. I was in my early 20s. I had my piece of paper from one of the top conservatories in the country. It was time to begin. It was time to pick a place on the map and begin. I always thought I would end up in New York. I went to Carnegie with Broadway in mind. I was going to be Michael McElroy. Things had shifted along the way. Somewhere during my third year of school, I think it was, I realized I was never going to be Michael McElroy. I let that go in order to grab hold of something greater. 60% of conservatory training happens in front of a mirror for one reason or another. All your dance classes, some of your voice classes too, all utilize the mirror as means of teaching you how to self-correct. You learn a ton about yourself. There's no getting around it. Now, the mirror is literal and figurative. At some point, I seized the opportunity to begin to understand the things that make me unique. I grabbed a hold of the opportunity to become the best version of myself I could be, and I never looked back. The 4 years changed me in untold ways. Conservatory training was about stretching, and it was also about defining space for yourself. Now, you weren't always rewarded for it. but you were often asked to reach for things that felt beyond your grasp. Because of this boundary testing, we graduated from university with a strong sense of what we could do really well. It's never a bad idea to take an inventory of the strengths you've developed as you push forward into the working world. You can lead with your strengths. After 4 years, I knew I had the ability to steady myself under pressure. It helped in audition rooms. I was usually readily empathetic. It allowed me to inhabit characters who were different from me, and I knew how to comport myself and infuse my work with a little style. It wasn't much, but it's what I was coming with. It's not that learning stops once you toss up your graduation cap. Quite the contrary. That chapter of conventional and structured education may be over for you, but whatever your area of focus was in school, you'll earn advanced degrees in problem solving, team building, rebranding, risk assessment, media management, and many other subjects in life's continuous course study. The syllabus is vague, the stakes are higher, and the multiple choice tests can feel interminable, but the good news is, you're the one handing out the evaluations at the end of a term. You will be the one tracking your development along the way. You can change course, extend deadlines, double the homework assignments, or cut them in half. When I first set my sights on New York, I had dreams of heading back to Broadway right away, even though there was a growing trend that saw the choice roles going to television and film stars. Working your way up the ranks in the theater and becoming a marquee name on the strength of your work alone seemed to be a thing of the past. Nevertheless, I had my piece of paper and a dream. I figured it was going to be tough, but I was game. Graduating seniors from CMU get a real entree into the business with what's called a showcase. It's our version of a job fair. Most of the conservatories and drama programs will arrange them on both coasts. Students prepare a very short solo performance of some sort, and they also will perform a short scene with a classmate. Well-established agents, managers, and casting directors attend. The hope is to make enough reliable connections out of the showcase to get a foot in the door of the industry. If not a whole foot, a toe would be nice. After the showcase, you get a sheet of paper with a list of the people who would like you to contact them. There were kids who every casting director, agent, and manager wanted to meet. There were a few who, for a myriad of reasons, received little to no interest. And then there were the rest of us who had something. After the New York showcase results, I committed to taking the few meetings I had and making that enough. Other professional fields have similar ways of scouting candidates coming out of college. It is a big opportunity. But I promise you, it won't be your only opportunity. Though showcase was important, it wasn't everything, even if that's how it felt at the time. In the end, in a recurring theme, it was much more about what you did with what you were given than about what you were given. I signed with a small agency in New York and made plans to move to the city at the end of the summer. The Los Angeles showcase hadn't even happened yet, and I'd already committed to New York. It's maybe a little telling of what I thought of my chances for making it in Hollywood, before I'd ever visited, of course. In preparation for the Hollywood showcase, we returned to Pittsburgh and retooled our performances. Many of us had spent the year getting as fit as we'd ever been in our lives. We'd spent 3.5 years prior focused on craft, but before showcase, we heard that Hollywood likes him pretty, so we focused on pretty. From graduating classes that preceded us, we had seen how Hollywood could snatch you right up from the showcase and put you on a path to superstardom. Joe Manganiello, Matt Bomer, Abby Bramel, Cody DiPablo all had incredible showcase results and subsequent early success. Now, I was still very much committed to staying on the East Coast, but I thought, hey, if we're going to Hollywood anyway, might as well take a real swing at it, right? Right? The Los Angeles leg of the showcase went well, way better than I expected. After the performances, I had a handful of meetings to set, and I was enjoying the city's vibe. The first powerful executive I met in Los Angeles was a woman of real integrity. Lucy Cavallo was vice president of casting at CBS. After the showcase, she invited me to meet with her in her office in Hollywood. Her walls were decorated with posters from the many hit shows she and her office had cast over the years. Lucy spoke plainly and in a way that felt sincere. We had a loose and easy conversation about the training at Carnegie, my early Broadway experience, her responsibility and position at the network. Eventually, Lucy cut to it. "So when are you moving to LA? I want to put you on TV." We've all heard the cliche Hollywood stories about charlatans and rubes. The town is littered with stories that started similar to mine, but ended in a very different way. Animal instinct will be your guide for some of it at the start. Honor those early bits of information sent to your brain and your senses in a first meeting. You will sharpen your instincts and good judgment over time. I only had good feelings and instincts about Lucy's sincerity. But if trusting someone doesn't work out the way you planned, don't be too hard on yourself. You'll only be better at spotting similar signs earlier the next time. The same is true when someone's straight with you. You can feel it as sure as anything. You'll learn to spot those signs too. During the showcase visit, I was on my own in Los Angeles, 3,000 miles away from home. I was taking it all in, assessing for myself. When the week was up, I would have a very big decision to make. Palm trees and the Pacific, or the concrete jungle? It felt like the first major decision of my young adult life. The first decision I would make entirely on my own. As I mulled my options, I reconnected with Jacques Smith, who, like Michael, had been like a big brother to me during my time in Rent. Jacques had played Benny in the show, a Princeton grad and one of the most genuinely good-natured men I've ever known. Jacques was another hero. If I did decide to give Los Angeles a try, Jacques offered me the couch in his one-bedroom apartment for as long as I needed it. The plum rolls in New York are going to television stars, right? More and more, I was thinking I should take the time to find out what was cracking in L.A. If all goes well, I mean, it could turn out to be the straightest shot back to Broadway, I thought. I came back from L.A. singing a new song about 70-degree weather, Hollywood Boulevard, and swimming pools. I felt a surprising pull west, and I saw no reason to ignore it. Dad, however, had a long list of reasons to ignore it. When I got back to Philly and filled my parents in on the appeal of the West Coast, I was met with a dose of their skepticism and fear. I suppose it's understandable. As a parent myself now, I can imagine how difficult it must be to trust the intuition of your child. I will always be Leslie and Yvette's child. But though they might not have been ready to admit it, I was no longer a child. And I'd absolutely meant what I said before when we came to our understanding over Aida. I laid claim to making the next big decision in independence. I intended to honor that promise to myself. Dad tried reason. We don't know anyone in L.A. What if you run into trouble? How are you going to get home? He tried blunt truth. I think you're making a mistake. Now, I respected his trepidation. He hadn't seen what I'd seen. He hadn't met the people I'd met. I barely knew a soul in that city, yet there was a calm in my spirit as I explored and tried to get a lay of the land and a feel for my new adventure. I had seen the signs for myself in Hollywood, and though they were pointing in an unexpected direction, I was prepared to put my own intuition to the test. As a child, you rarely get the final word on anything. But each one of us gets to a point when we have to say, "I've got this. Making decisions is my job now." The disagreement over the move created a rift in the relationship with my dad for many years. It was about more than the move, of course. Our stuff went way back. But the move exacerbated it. Leaving home is a necessary rite of passage that should probably take us as far afield as we can possibly go. The first flight from the nest should entail some risk. The territory is expansive. Explore. I moved to L.A. at the end of the summer with a plan to give it 6 months. I had $1,200, Jacques' couch, Lucy Cavallo's office number, some training, and a whole lot of heart. Before the move, I'd touched base with Lucy's office to let her know I was making my way to the West Coast after all. I had to account for the errors I was sure to make at some point. Making decisions on my own steam was new. I lowered the stakes of the cross-country move by reminding myself that New York was just a plane ride away. If those first 6 months had been awful, if I'd shown up and found the city and situations working against me, if I couldn't get solid footing or make a friend, I told myself I wouldn't be ashamed to pack it up and try something else. The universe is speaking to you always if you're willing to listen. And I was listening. I was looking for a sign, any sign that I could get, that this wasn't some huge mistake like my folks had feared. On my first night in L.A., I got a call to audition for a CBS series the following day. Jacques graciously agreed to drive me the 45 minutes there and back. The audition went well. They asked me to return the following day, and Jacques agreed to drive me once more. I read for the producers the next afternoon, and 2 hours later they called to offer me the job. My intuition was confirmed, and I had my sign in about 48 hours. The role was only a recurring one-day guest star as the fingerprint technician on CSI Miami, but to me it represented much more. It was the beginning of adulthood. My intuition hadn't steered me wrong. The byproduct of trusting Lucy was the confirmation that I could trust myself. The Hollywood game is not so different from any other competitive field. Supply and demand often rule the day. You can choose to play the game and fit the demand, or you can dig deep and offer something your field has never seen before and stand out. The latter is much harder, and for a newcomer, much riskier. When I arrived in Hollywood, there was arguably more opportunity for black actors and for actors of color than ever before. There is even more all these years later. But there was still a tendency toward tokenism. The lure of tokenism in my business, and in any business, really, is that it's easy. Hiring a few or the single minority player can keep you safe from a certain type of scrutiny or criticism. The one Asian on a team, or the single gay person, or the one physically disabled person, or the lone black character can make a project appear woke or edgy because of its diversity. But I would submit that if you have a person from an underrepresented group on your team, and you aren't tapping them for their unique and varied perspectives and contributions, it may be tokenism. And if it's tokenism, it's always a missed opportunity. Tokens are window dressing mostly. They're props. You can make a living as a token, but you'll always long for more. I showed up in Hollywood and tacitly agreed to play this game. More than that, while I longed for more, for some time I allowed myself to think this was all I would ever be used for. I'll be the token, I thought. I'll work twice as hard to give these stock characters and caricatures a reason to exist that goes beyond filling quotas and serving functions, but it is what it is. I probably said the words out loud at some point, but to think them was enough to make it my reality on and off for almost a decade. It was limiting, and it was painful. I cast a reductive vision for myself at the outset. And it was 10 years of maturation and growth before I could dismantle and demolish the pattern for myself. In the beginning, you audition for almost every call that comes in. If it doesn't cross some moral or ethical line for you, remembering you must retain ownership of your yes and your no, Your answer is almost always yes to a potential opportunity. There were times when I was vying against other brothers in the Hollywood shuffle to play a three-dimensional human being, but there were more times when we were in competition for the token. This process is definitely BYOD. The D stands for dignity. There were times when I could bend to expectations, and there were times when I couldn't quite twist myself into enough of a pretzel to make it palatable for myself or my potential employers. I remember testing for a pilot early on. In a scene where I was out to dinner with the two women who were my bosses on the show, I was getting the note back from the producers and casting that the scene wasn't working. "Can he be more street in that scene? We just need him to be more street." Now, just how street were they expecting me to be at a meeting with my bosses in a 5-star restaurant? The answer was very. I couldn't quite make it happen. It was a step too far for me in that moment. What I have to own, what I have to take responsibility for, is the vision at the outset that over time began to do damage. As a young man, my thoughts were born out of strategy, ambition, and survival instinct. And in my initial vision, I sold myself short. Don't sell yourself short. You will meet people along the way who will be lining up to place limits on you. You don't need to beat them to the punch. Vulture did a popular recap of each episode of a short-lived network series I was on. Now, on screen, I was doing my best to turn in a thoughtful, honest, and three-dimensional performance. It was sometimes at odds with the material I was being given, but I was doing the best I could. Still, I wasn't prepared for the moment I read the recap following the episode in which my character was initially introduced for the season-long arc I had on the show. The author cuts to the chase and gives me a funny nickname that'll be used in all the recaps moving forward. One line read, "Reserving an especially loud shriek for the actor playing Token," in reference to a moment of screen time I shared with a black actress and dancer. She wrote, "I don't think they're doing much sleeping," says Token's sister, Tokenetta. In front of the camera, I try to lead with my humanity. Sometimes I fall short, but it's usually where I'm coming from. In this situation, my best efforts in front of the camera didn't matter. There was no mention of them ever. I was there to serve a function, and the function came before my humanity. I abhorred the function. Token has no past, and Token's future is dubious, so Token's present is threadbare. In my tacit cosign to gain access and make a living, it hadn't occurred to me that Token wouldn't be limited to just a function on screen. That reality was painful enough, but when I saw the world renaming me, it was time to put away childish things. Chapter 5. Permission to Fail. I don't ever lose. I either win or I learn. Nelson Mandela. I've never seen any life transformation that didn't begin with the person in question finally getting sick of their own bullshit. Elizabeth Gilbert. There's a space for safe and bland in every industry. I had 2 feet planted in that space. Guided by instinct and faith at the start, moving to Los Angeles was the riskiest thing I'd ever done. But in a short time, I'd gone from daring to boring. I was so busy playing the game that I forgot why any of it mattered in the first place. That was as good a reason to make a change as any I've ever heard. During those first 5 years or so in L.A., I'd gotten the hang of things. I was booking a fair number of jobs. My parents could regularly turn on their televisions in Philadelphia and see their son, which was a thrill for them. For me too, I admit. But there was still a lot missing. Everything changed in an instant the first time I really gave myself the room and the permission to fail spectacularly. Like anything worthwhile, Failing spectacularly takes a bit of practice, and I had none. I look back at my college years, and this is my one regret. Now, I made plenty of mistakes in school, but I wish the environment had encouraged and provided more room for failure. My training hadn't included any focus on audacity. Nothing in my training encouraged or spoke to the value of taking real risks, and so I wasn't in the practice of taking any. The tuition came as a particular hardship for my folks, and I racked up student loans in the shortfall of financial aid. I took the sacrifice seriously. I wanted my transcripts to reflect the seriousness with which I approached my education. I did really well and graduated with honors from Carnegie Mellon University. I learned what was expected of me, and in most cases, I delivered. Because of the grading system in place, and quite possibly, I say in truth and with respect, the egos of some of my professors, there's no premium placed on risk. That meant wasted valuable time because risk is much harder once you leave campus and stakes go up. More room should be made on our college campuses for trial and error. You should be encouraged to fall on your face, to fail in service of an ideal or a strong impulse. When you find yourself on the ground after a big leap, you dust yourself off and commit to failing smarter next time. The path to moments of greatness in your life will be paved in part with your spectacular failures. Keep going. Get shame and fear out of your periphery as soon as you possibly can, and keep going. It's never too late to learn to risk. Accessing your emotions can put you in touch with a fuel that can push you into high performance. For better or worse, anger has always been a tremendous octane for me. It's a tricky one, though. High doses can have adverse or even the opposite desired effect and siphon off energy a little at a time instead. Learning the right equation to optimize forward momentum, and also learning how and when I needed to take some deep, meditative breaths and get on the hunt for an alternative fuel for a particular moment, has been part of my life's journey. But it was anger that pushed me to the point of my first major breakthrough. I was in my mid-20s when I got the chance to work with a hero of mine, Mr. Billy Porter. Billy is a maker of things beautiful in the highest order. In his storied and impressive professional career as an entertainer, he's been a director, a singer, a curator, an actor, a dancer, a writer. Though if you were to ask me, or any of Billy's students, his work as a teacher and mentor would rival his achievements in any one of these areas. Billy is known as a Tony and Grammy Award-winning star around the world, and I've learned a great many lessons at his feet. Chief among them was the time he pissed me off so bad, I was forced to fly. We were in Philadelphia with a new theater piece Billy had written and was directing. The central character was one he'd initially conceived for himself, but after some consideration, he called to offer it to me in his stead. I'm still humbled by the thought. Billy created an opportunity and an avenue for me at a time when not many were doing it for him. A decade later, Lin-Manuel would do a similar thing for an entire cast of underused and barely used talents in Hamilton. I think it's just about the holiest thing you can do in this business, leading another artist to the well of good gifts within them. I hope there's a special place in heaven for people who make this a part of their life's work. Being Alive, Billy's show, was an evening of songs curated and rearranged from the works of Stephen Sondheim, using a small cast made up entirely of African-American performers. We had premiered in Westport, Connecticut just a couple of months earlier. Philadelphia was the next stop in trying to iron out flaws in the 90-minute evening. Being Alive had potential, but ultimately we never got it quite right. Along the way, though, a disagreement about the treatment of a particular moment in the show presented my first real runway for failure. I did not meet the opportunity with gusto. There was a moment, deep into Act Two, where Billy had written what I deemed a classic Billy Porter moment. The writing and arrangement of the tune pointed to big singing at the end. There were vocal ad-libs over an ensemble of singers. The moment called for passion, fervor, fire. On an emotional scale ranging from 1 to 10, 10 being lifting the roof off the theater, Billy was looking for a 10. The problem was, I was never really comfortable at 10. It was dangerous and unpredictable out on that limb. I preferred making calculated, intellectual choices throughout an evening and arriving at a predetermined emotional ending in the cleanest and safest way possible. Using my intellect along the way would ensure that no one could accuse me of not knowing what I was doing up there. It allowed me to maintain my sense of control. Billy, keying in on my resistance, starts to ask me to relinquish my tight grip of control over the moment. My thought is, nah, this is a sure thing. What you're asking me to do is not. What you're asking me to do is risky. I've worked to increase the size and power of my voice for years. It's gotten better, but it is what it is. Had Billy stayed in the role, I had no doubt that he would have played the moment perfectly. Billy would have torn the roof off and the house down. That's what Billy did. That's not what I did. In a note session, after an early performance, Billy says, "Leslie, I see you making the choice to downplay that moment in Act Two. I'd love to see you try something else tomorrow night." "Nah," I think. The next night, "Hey, Leslie, I would really still love to see you take the stage and your space in that moment. It's staged and written to support you. Just give it a try tomorrow night." "Okay, I'll see if I can make that happen," I say, though I have no intention of making it happen. From my fearful perspective, what I was doing worked, and there was never any way I was going to deliver the moment Billy was asking me for in the way that he wanted. I didn't have what it would take, and if I could avoid facing the inevitable failure, I was more than happy to. Billy comes to my dressing room after the next performance to talk through a few things. Eventually, we get to that moment again. "I love everything you're doing, but I see and feel you resisting my direction here. What is that about?" he asks in earnest. "I'm not you, Billy," I blurt out. "I'll never be you. I know what you're asking me to do, and I cannot deliver that moment the way that you would." Billy looked like his heart broke for a moment. His eyes softened, and he grabbed me by my shoulders. "I would never ask you to do it like me. I don't want you to be me," he said in the kindest tone he could muster. "I want you to find your sixth gear. I know it's in there, and I feel you resisting. I don't know why, and I'm not sure how to help you. You've got to trust me. You have to let me see it, whatever it is. And if it doesn't work, we will try something else." I heard him in the deepest and truest parts of myself. I knew he was right. It was only fear that was stopping me from taking the leap at this point. He was building me up the way great coaches do, but my insecurity was too close to the surface to admit it in that moment. I couldn't let it go right then. Later that night, I downloaded with a castmate about the session Billy and I had had. I was angry at Billy for making this a sticking point. I was angry that he couldn't let it go. I was angry that he'd made it about trust, because that is exactly what it was about. Billy had called me on the carpet, and there was no way around it this time. In my anger, I surrendered. I told my castmate, "I'm going to do it tomorrow. I'm going to go so far in the direction that he wants that it's never a conversation again." I didn't know why my teacher wanted me to look like a fool in front of a theater full of strangers, but I committed to it anyway. I committed to failing. What Billy was asking me to do could quite possibly tank my performance and the ending of the show along with it, but if that's what he was willing to risk, so be it. I was full of fuel and ready to fail spectacularly, if only to show my mentor how wrong he was. The next evening, as the moment approached, I was furious. I was sick of the conversation. I was ready to show Billy once and for all that I knew my own limitations and that it was he who lacked trust in me. I sailed past 10 on the emotional scale and went for the 11. I screamed, I flailed, I jumped, I ran, I cried, I let go, I flew, I soared. It shook me. I had never felt so free in my work in my whole life. I knew nothing of this type of abandonment. It was a little frightening, and it was exhilarating. My teacher was right, and I am so grateful he didn't give up on me. To this day, I tell him often and without reservation, the ceiling I'd built for myself was broken that night, and the only reason I ever look back is to say thank God. In my willingness to fail, I flew instead. Years later, L.A. presented an opportunity to fail spectacularly as well. But this time, anger wasn't the fuel. Curiosity was. I'd grown so tired of the rut and niche I'd carved out for myself. I was tired of the uninspired work I was producing. I wasn't challenging myself, and I was so bored. Then I got a call to come in and read for the lead role in a new Wayans Brothers movie. The Wayans have a history of making satire and parody as good as anyone in the business. My first thought was, I'm funny sometimes, but I don't know if I'm Wayans Brothers funny. I took the audition anyway. I spent the next day working on the material, trying to come up with bits. A funny walk, maybe. A funny talk. It was all pretty lame. I put the material down for a bit to clear my head. Unexpected inspiration and clarity hit me like lightning. I picked up the material again to be sure that what I was inspired to do would work. The comedy made sense to me for the first time. I fought genuine laughter as I continued to try to learn my dialogue. I wrote notes to myself all over the script, cues that would keep me on track and remind me to honor my instincts and follow through, even when old habits and fear crept in and tempted me to a safer place. I wrote down, "Don't be funny. You are not funny. Do not make them laugh. This is a drama. Play it like Brando would play it." Simple enough, this was my bright idea. As I saw it, the characters were in a world that they took literally and completely seriously. My guy had no idea he was in a Wayans Brothers satire. My guy was living his life with a documentary camera crew following him. Simple enough. And scary enough. I drew a line in the sand for myself. This would be my first professional risk. Failure wasn't going to be a byproduct of the goal. Failure was the goal. If I went in and they didn't laugh once, if they called my agent after I left the room and said, "He was seriously the worst actor we've seen today. Not only is he not getting this job, do not send that actor in here ever again." It was only a win if it went as far as that. That's how not funny I had to be. I was prepared to defend my work and be dropped by my representation if it came to that. Young actors are taught to feel utterly disposable. You're always fearful that you'll be abandoned if you displease. But this was it. If I was to make myself proud and pull myself out of the inertia and boredom that had begun to sap my energy, this was the stand I had to make. If any of the worst-case scenario outcomes came to pass, I'd have my freedom in their place. What's a risk if there aren't any consequences? The audition room didn't laugh when I started. They didn't laugh as the scene progressed. They asked me to read one of the scenes again. I was more serious the second time through. The sillier the moment, the more I sank into the drama. The more I sank into the drama, the more they leaned in. I caught a smile from Marlin out of the corner of my eye, small laugh from Sean. The tension in the room dissipated. They worked with me for 15 minutes or so. They were kind and generous. It was way more fun than I had anticipated, and then it was over.